It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'll be hosting today's show. And what else would we be talking about in August 2013 other than the topic of sequestration? How many different views? How many different angles? How can you slice sequestration one different way? And I think we found it. We're going to be talking today to a bunch of people in the know on the issue of how sequestration is affecting not only the judiciary, the other branch of government, but how our disputes in our civil society that get resolved by adjudicators are being affected by sequestration. Joining me to talk about this angle on sequestration is with me in the studio is Brian Polisic, who is the general counsel of the Merit Systems Protection Board as of early this year. Congratulations, Brian, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Deborah. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. And also with me in the studio is Michael Nachmanoff, who is the federal public defender in the Eastern District of Virginia. And for those of you who are inside the Beltway, it's EDVA. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you very much, Deborah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And by phone is a guest that we've had multiple times on Fed Talk. For those of you who follow us, we have Bruce Moyer with us on the phone. Bruce is the counsel for government relations to the Federal Bar Association. And Bruce has been a frequent guest with us on Fed Talk. Bruce, thanks for rejoining us.
Good morning, Deborah. Great to be with you again.
Thank you, Bruce. So what I thought we would do for the first sort of introduction to the topic is have everybody who is listening get to know who our guests are and where, you know, where is it that you work and what's your insight into this relative issue, the sort of relative issue here on the table of sequestration and the judiciary. And Bruce, why don't we start with you?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks, Deborah, and good morning, everyone. I serve as the principal and founder of a consulting group called the Moyer Group, which provides government relations services to several clients, and several of those are involved in the federal judicial system in various ways. Today I'm on the show wearing the hat as counsel for government relations to the Federal Bar Association, which is a national legal organization of practitioners and judges who you would find in the federal court system, attorneys who represent litigants before the federal courts, as well as judges who decide cases within the federal district courts and circuit courts around the country. So the problem and the challenge of sequestration has enormous consequences for the federal court system, and I'll be happy to talk a little bit more about that as the program evolves.
Great. Thanks a lot, Bruce. And Michael, you are the federal public defender in the Eastern District of Virginia, and I meant to tell our guests that you've been in the position since the office opened in 2002, but why don't you tell people what the public defender is and how you came to this position?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The federal public defender system is the result of the famous Supreme Court case, Gideon v. Wainwright, which was decided exactly 50 years ago, which is a tremendous and bitter irony that the federal public defender system in indigent defense faces this crisis at a time we should be celebrating the gains that we have made in this country to provide equal access to justice under the law. Federal defenders represent indigent defendants in federal court all across the country. I'm the federal public defender for the Eastern District of Virginia, which includes this area, Northern Virginia, down to Richmond and Norfolk, so the eastern half of the state. It's always in the top 10 of the largest districts in the country. And of course, it has a lot of very interesting and high profile cases because of the federal agencies that are located in the Eastern District of Virginia, including the Pentagon.
Right,
and
principally
the CIA.
The Pentagon, right.
And, exactly.
And Central Intelligence.
And so you might think that in the federal courts, that means that federal defenders and lawyers under the Criminal Justice Act in private practice who are paid an hourly rate represent some proportion of criminal defendants. But the reality is that we represent almost all of them. 90% of people charged in federal court cannot afford to retain their own lawyer. It is simply too expensive, except for the wealthiest people in this country. And so federal defenders, along with lawyers in private practice that we refer to as CJA lawyers, represent over 90% of all defendants. Federal public defenders represent the majority of those defendants, and that's over 200,000 people a year nationwide.
And Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you come to this position as the public defender, the federal public defender in one of the largest and, I don't want to say most important, but, you know, we talk about the seat of the government, Washington, D.C., it spills over across the river where, you know, very important functions of our government, significant functions of our government occur. And, of course, the judicial disputes get resolved in your district. How did you come to that job?
Well, I consider myself very, very lucky to be part of the federal defender system and to be the federal defender in the Eastern District of Virginia. I began my career as a judicial law clerk for the Honorable Laney M. Brinkema, who is a wonderful judge in the Eastern District of Virginia. And I went into private practice, became a partner at the law firm of Cohen, Gettings & Dunham, where I practiced federal criminal defense, civil litigation, and practiced in the state courts as well. When the office was opened in 2002, I joined my partner, Frank Dunham, who was a wonderful man and a great mentor to me, and came over as his deputy, and we founded the office together. I took over as the federal public defender now more than 6 years ago. It's hard to believe that so much time has passed, and it has been a great privilege to maintain the legacy that he left behind in the Eastern District of Virginia.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I talk about people who go to work every day and are fortunate enough to get paid to do God's work. But when you think about the services you provide to our society, it's extremely important. But we're going to talk a whole lot more about that during the show, why those services are so important, and what is the effect of sequestration on it. Brian, you are the general counsel at the Merit, I said MSPB, Merit Systems Protection Board. You became the general counsel, congratulations again, in early 2013. The MSPB, you know, just to be clear so that people don't, you know, write me and tell me that the MSPB is not part of the judiciary. I know that. It's not that branch of government. You're within the executive branch, but you're adjudicators. Mm-hmm. And you adjudicate, the main role of the MSPB is to adjudicate disputes and adverse actions that the government takes against federal employees, and sequestration, as we heard in the intro, Mike Causey's promo for his own column, you know, has caused tens of thousands of furloughs, and it might cause rifts. And that all gets adjudicated at MSPB, which is why we're so glad to have MSPB on the show here today. But tell us a little bit about your job and yourself and how you came to the MSPB.
Well, as you mentioned, I am currently the general counsel, and I've been in that position for 7 or 8 months. So I'm still brand new, but I came to that position because prior to that, I had worked in the United States Senate, and I was a staffer on the now retired Senator Akaka's staff on the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. And our committee had oversight over the Merit Systems Protection Board, over the Federal Labor FLRA, the Federal Labor Relations Authority, the Office of Special Counsel. So we had developed relationships.
For people in the know, you were on the Federal Workforce Subcommittee.
That's
the in-town lingo, is that Brian was on the Federal Workforce Subcommittee on the Senate side.
That's right.
And so very important oversight subcommittee in Congress over the federal community.
With respect to federal workforce issues,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
So we had had relationships with all of these agencies. And when the position became open at the board, I was fortunate enough to be considered and selected.
Well, congratulations. I'm sure you bring a lot, you know, from one branch of government to the other branch of government.
It's been interesting.
Right? You know, it's like switching sides. It must be very interesting. And I know our listeners want to know a lot about, particularly the DOD community. They want to know a lot about how MSPB is handling the furlough appeals that were filed as a result of sequestration, which is what you're going to be talking about with us.
Right.
But we do need to take the first break of our show. And when we come back, we will certainly be following up in much more detail with our guests. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. With me today are three guests who are certainly people in the know with regard to the effects of sequestration, not only on the judiciary, which is a branch of government that really has sort of been silent on in the run-up and the aftermath of sequestration, but also the internal sort of adjudicators with inside the federal government, MSPB. If you just tuned in, with me is Brian Polasek. He is the general counsel at the MSPB. We also have Michael Nachmanoff. He is the federal public defender for the Eastern District of Virginia. And with us by phone is Bruce Moyer, who is the counsel for government relations to the Federal Bar Associations. Bruce, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so Bruce, I thought we'd start off with you. You've been around town I don't want to say it like that, Bruce, but you've been around town. You've been here for a while. You're like me.
Okay.
We've been around. You know, in my intro just now back on the air, I mentioned that even inside the Beltway, you really just don't hear about the effects of sequestration outside of, you know, the executive branch. And all of a sudden, in the most recent news cycle, it's sort of trickling out. What do you make of that? What do you make of the fact that that branch has been sort of quiet for a while?
Well, it's due to a couple of factors, Deborah. First of all, sequestration kicked in beginning in March, and yet the impact upon it, the general public has been a very slow-moving phenomenon. Congress and the White House mitigated the most blunt impact of sequestration through what they did in permitting many departments and agencies to reprogram their funding. They permitted the FAA, for example, to use tomorrow's funding for airport improvements to keep air traffic controllers on the job. They did similar things with meat inspectors in a variety of ways, aside from furloughs in some agencies and departments. The public really has not yet seen the broad impact of sequestration. In the federal court system, both due to the size of the federal courts, as well as the way courts are decentralized, the immediate impact has been somewhat diffused, but it is a growing crisis that is beginning to make itself known now, both through the severe cutbacks that Mike Nachmanoff and his staff and other federal defender offices have undergone, as well as significant cutbacks in funding that courts have begun to transform into cutbacks in their operations in terms of limitations on hours that courts are open, and in other ways that we'll talk about a little bit later. Mm-hmm. The most important thing, I think, to remember is that the federal court system is the third branch, as it's called, of the federal government. You have the executive branch, you have the legislative branch, and then you have the judicial branch. Compared to the executive and legislative branches, the judicial branch is quite small. Even though it's in a co-equal, coordinate branch of government, it's comprised of only about 30,000 employees.
Wow.
That is small compared to the size of those two other branches, each unto themselves.
Right, and Bruce, you'll appreciate this as another lawyer, and of course I have two lawyers in the room with me. You know, isn't it ironic? It's the final word in our society, too. It's the smallest branch of government, and it is the final word.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As a nation that holds itself accountable to the rule of law, the federal courts are responsible for fairly and effectively adjudicating some of the most significant criminal and civil disputes of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they have begun to become hobbled by this process of sequestration and the automatic budget cuts that come out of sequestration.
And you sort of alluded to it about being the adjudicator of criminal and civil disputes. What are the courts? I've read, obviously, in preparation for the show, a lot of literature that's just gone out to Congress from the court system, starting to you know, for lack of a better word, petition the legislative body to up their funding. How is it manifesting in the federal court system, Bruce?
Well, it's being manifested, aside from the federal defender problems,
yeah.
I'm going to allow Mike Nachmanoff to discuss. It's surfaced in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
It has brought about delay in the prompt hearing of cases by the federal courts, keeping in mind that these include bankruptcy cases where certainty and promptness are critical to the outcomes of companies and individuals who are undergoing bankruptcy. It also can impair public safety, keeping in mind that the judiciary employs about 6,000 law enforcement officers who are called probation and pretrial service officers. These are the people who supervise individuals in the community after they've been convicted of a crime and subsequently released from, as well as defendants awaiting trial. That kind of supervision, which, by the way, is at a record all-time level, is necessary to being able to have these kinds of folks out in the community and yet supervised and monitored by court law enforcement officers. Staffing in those areas has been particularly cut back, which can in turn dampen public safety in the ability to engage in drug testing and mental health services for offenders, for GPS tracking, in a number of ways that involves the safe reintegration of these defendants back into the community. And so there are a variety of ways, both economic in terms of the impact by delayed justice.
Yeah.
And as we know, there's the aphorism, justice delayed is justice denied. As well as can even reach into the quality and the magnitude of safety in communities. There are a variety of ways, including even the security within
right,
courthouses themselves, that have been impacted. by sequestration and these budget cuts.
Yeah, no, I'm sort of fascinated. I think the town forgot, you know, not Congress, but I think the town sort of forgot about that branch of government in terms of the impact sequestration. All of the talk in the town was how it would affect the delivery of executive branch services. So to me, this is a very interesting facet that hasn't been explored. And Michael, my question for you, the way I want to present it to you is, I think if you're inside the Beltway, you know, but if you're not inside the Beltway, this fact isn't known to you. But Bruce sort of alluded to it just now. A lot of agencies went back and got, I forgot the term of art, but they got exemptions and reprogramming of money so that their workforce wouldn't be impacted. And one of them was the Department of Justice, which is your adversary in these proceedings. So as I understand, but you'll tell me, Michael, if I'm wrong, as I understand, there are no furloughs occurring in the United States Attorney's offices or at Maine Justice, where the line prosecutors in civil and criminal proceedings that the United States brings, they have not been impacted at all by sequestration. Am I correct by that?
That's exactly right. The Department of Justice was given permission, sought permission, and was granted permission by Congress to reallocate funds to avoid furloughs. And so no Justice Department employee, and that includes the U.S. Attorney's Office, our counterparts, the federal prosecutors, all of the investigative agencies, the FBI, the DEA, the Marshals, all of the other federal law enforcement agencies, and the Bureau of Prisons, none of them suffered a single day of furlough in 2013 as compared to federal defenders,
right,
who have already suffered collectively more than 12,500 days of furloughs.
Right. So the federal public defender, are you part of Branch 3 of the government? Is that where your funding comes from?
That's correct. We're part of the judiciary. We are a small part of the judiciary. And as Bruce alluded to, the entire budget for the judiciary is a small proportion of the total budget. It's, in fact, I think, 0.2% of 1% of the entire federal budget. It's a little bit under $7 billion. The Department of Justice, by contrast, one executive branch agency involved in the courts, is $27.5 billion. The Bureau of Prisons alone is a $7 billion budget. So looking at the total cost of the third branch of government, it is dwarfed by spending in other places. And so cuts have had a tremendously disproportionate impact across the board. But federal defenders in particular within the judiciary have been hit incredibly hard. And part of that is because the way the judiciary is structured, there are certain areas that are exempt from cuts. For example, the salaries of judges, and by judicial conference policy, other areas within the judiciary. And so those cuts were exacerbated for federal defenders, but also in other areas for probation and pretrial, as Bruce mentioned, and the clerk's office and bankruptcy as well. And so we had to absorb these cuts that were greater by proportion than they were in other agencies where they were spread across the board. Mm-hmm. Of course, we also had to implement them within a 6 or 7 month time frame.
As opposed to over the year.
Exactly, which obviously increased the loss and could be dealt with only in certain ways. And finally, unlike other parts of the government, and in some ways other parts of the courts, federal defenders can't do 80% of the work for our clients. What we do is a constitutional mandate. The work must be done. And so, for example, in my own office,
you're defending the indigent who are in criminal cases brought by the United States government.
That's correct.
And what is the policy behind? Explain to our listeners, because we all went to law school. We know this. You know, you learn it. It's like, what's the reason why in our society, in our civil society, that we believe that it's been interpreted to have a constitutional mandate that if you can't afford a lawyer, Sixth Amendment, if you can't afford one, then the government will give you one. What's the reason for that?
It's one of the most fundamental principles upon which this country is founded. It is the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution. And as the Supreme Court interpreted in Gideon v. Wainwright, it is a meaningless right to be represented if only the wealthy can afford to retain counsel.
It's about equality.
And so if we believe in equal access to justice under the law, then people who are facing the deprivation of liberty need to have not just a warm body standing right next to them, but somebody who can meaningfully defend their rights. And by defending their rights, they protect all of our rights.
Right. And that's what the Federal Public Defender's Office does.
It does, every day.
Yeah. Now, we do need to take our mid-show break, but we're going to come back, Michael, and start with you, because you sort of teed up for us, in general, the umbrella view or the overall view of how these cuts have disproportionately hit your part of the judiciary. But I want to get into a little bit more detail with you. But we do need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote, and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting today's show. And today's show is an angle on sequestration that I think has been ignored in this town. And I'm delighted to be able to bring insight into this issue to our listeners. We're talking about the effects of sequestration on the other branch of, mostly on the other branch of government, the judiciary. We do have with us in the studio Brian Polasek, who is the general counsel of the MSPB, which is not part of the judiciary, but they are the number one adjudicator of disputes inside the federal government. In addition to Brian, we also have Michael Nachmanoff, who is the federal public defender for the Eastern District of Virginia. We also have with us one of our favorite guests, who we always like to have with us a couple times a year. We have Bruce Moyer. He is the counsel for government relations to the Federal Bar Association. Before we took our last break, Michael, you and I were talking about the sort of proportionate share of how sequestration cuts have affected this third branch of government. And you sort of gave us a macro view of it. But drill down a little. Let people know what it really means.
Absolutely. The effect of the sequester has really been devastating. And it's not been devastating in terms of what will happen. It's been devastating in terms of what has already happened. In my office in the Eastern District of Virginia, we are already 10% below our needed staffing. And we have lost staff as a direct result of the sequester. I've been forced to lay off staff. I've had an employee who is a reservist voluntarily activate in order to get off the payroll as a service to his colleagues. And I've had three employees who have taken early retirement who had no intention of retiring and did so really in an effort to help the office through this terrible time. So we've lost really valuable employees who have tremendous institutional knowledge, and that did not spare us from furloughs. Every single employee from the person who answers the phone to myself has had to take a loss of pay of 2 weeks in this fiscal year to make up the budget shortfall. And the reason for that is federal defenders have fixed costs that they simply can't avoid paying. Salary, benefits, rent make up 90% of federal defenders' budgets. The remaining 10% are all case-related costs. We don't have extra programs that we can choose not to fund. Therefore, that extra 10% covers expert fees, travel, investigation, things that are needed to provide an adequate defense. Mm-hmm. For example, We just finished a two-month trial in Norfolk involving Somali pirates. It was a very serious case. The death penalty was at issue. My lawyers and paralegals investigators worked 7 days a week for 2 months. During that time, they had to take 10 days of furloughs. Now, these are not furloughs in which they took the day off. They worked for our client the entire time.
How does that happen in our country where people go to work and don't get paid because of politics? It's just, how does that happen to people?
It's outrageous. And the future holds even worse. In order to avoid furloughs in the coming year, federal defenders have terminated staff and will have to terminate staff in the future. Now, the executive committee of the Judicial Conference and the courts have recognized this terrible crisis, and they're doing their best mm-hmm. with limited resources to stave off the worst hemorrhaging of staff so that the federal defenders are not irreparably harmed. And we're very grateful for those actions. But federal defenders are still facing a 10% cut in the future, which is why we need congressional action. We need, whether it's through appropriations or through an anomaly, we need the indigent defense function to be adequately funded, because this is a cost that will be accrued by the government, and it will be more expensive as federal defenders are not there to do it. Indigent defendants will still have a right to counsel. The courts will have to appoint lawyers in private practice. We have the benefits of economies of scale. We have the benefits of expertise. Many of my lawyers speak foreign languages. Many of my lawyers have security clearances. When we can't take these cases, the defendants will be represented often by very competent lawyers in private practice, but the nature of what they do will make it more expensive.
Right. And of course, you have to explain that those, when the courts appoint them an attorney who's in private practice, the government still pays.
That's exactly right.
They're not doing that pro bono. They're getting paid. They get paid from a different funding source. You know, it's what our government's become in funding, you know, over the last few decades of smoke and mirror funding. And I do want to, before we end the show, I want to come back to Bruce and you and talk about the effort by the chief judges of the district courts to sort of bring this to light. And of course, you know, Michael, you testified just recently before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But I know our listeners, many of our listeners are in agencies where furloughs occurred. And for them, they have a dispute with the government. And which is why we have MSPB with us on the show. And I want to ask Brian to give us where MSPB is at in processing, you know, all the thousands, because I've read about it, the thousands of furlough appeals that have come in an agency of how many FTEs do you have?
Less than 200.
And how many furlough appeals came in as of the last count?
As of this morning, we received over 32,000 appeals that were related to furloughs. That's in addition to 5,000 other cases that we've received on other matters that are generally appealable to the board under the law.
Mm-hmm.
And for some comparison, during the last fiscal year, our
before
agency,
furloughs,
but before sequestration,
right,
our agency had received about 5,000 appeals that had come in, about 5,500. We've received over 32,000 furlough appeals this year, and we're getting close to the 40,000 mark total. So as you can see, it's quite an increase.
Well, it's just going to shut you down.
Well, we're doing what we can. I'm confident in saying it's not going to shut us down, but it's definitely fair to say that we're very, very overwhelmed right mm-hmm. now. We're a very small agency, and you know, we're doing the best we can.
So has MSPB had furloughs?
We have not. As of today, we have not been furloughed. We're a small agency. Our leadership made some good decisions fiscally. So for the moment, our agency has not had to furlough any of our own employees. Mm-hmm. But that's this fiscal year. We'll see what happens next
year. Of course, we're all going to be talking about the CR, the continuing resolution that we all know is coming.
Right.
Can you tell us, can you give us, Brian, some insight into how the furlough appeals are being processed?
Sure.
So that people can sort of understand and where they came from. My understanding from, but it's what I read in the press, it doesn't necessarily mean it's accurate, is that the bulk of the appeals came from a DOD agency.
That's right. At least as of yesterday, when I looked, about 98% of the furlough appeals that we've received have come from employees of the Department of Defense. And with respect to where we're at in the process, you have to keep in mind that this really just started happening for us in early to mid-July. It's literally been weeks that this has come to us. So, I remember back in early July when I heard that we had gotten 200 appeals in one day, and I was shocked. And I think by the end of July, we were receiving upwards of 2,000 per day. I mean, it's just been very, very overwhelming to deal with. From a process standpoint, mm-hmm.
yeah.
the appeals are coming into our regions. We have regional offices across the country. They're being filed there, and our regions are doing what we call docketing the appeals, which is in and of itself a very timely process. And what that means in layman terms is that we're entering the information into our system so that we can move forward and then make decisions with respect to adjudicating them in the most efficient manner possible.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen reports. I was thinking how to put this. I've seen reports that have said that the MSPB is delaying these appeals or suspending them, and that's not really the case. That doesn't tell the whole story. What we're doing is gathering the information, processing it, and trying to put ourselves in the best position to adjudicate these, like I said, in the most efficient manner possible.
Yeah.
Whether that means consolidating them by claims or consolidating them by components or geographic location, we're trying to make those decisions right now.
And I imagine, was anybody around? Was it 84, the air traffic controller?
I believe it was 81.
81.
Yeah, that's sort of the best example
right.
we have for comparison.
Because when they all got fired, didn't almost everybody file MSPB appeals? And they were, I forgot the thousands.
That's my understanding. But again, for comparison, at that point, we received about 11,000 appeals. And we were double the size, of course. We had about 400 employees, and now we have 198. So, and keep in mind, all those appeals came from one agency, and they covered one personnel action, termination.
Because of a strike, right.
Because of a strike.
They went on strike, they got fired because they went on strike.
Right, but this, it's apples and oranges currently, because we're talking about different employees all over the country, different federal agencies, different components within those agencies, different deciding officials. It's a whole different situation right now. And you had asked where we're at. We are hoping to have all of these cases docketed by early September. Our people are working around the clock to do this, and hopefully shortly after Labor Day, we'll have the cases docketed and then be able to move forward with the adjudication process for DOD appeals. We are currently processing and adjudicating non-DOD appeals.
Mm-hmm. So when you say docketing, because I'm in the MSPB world myself, does that mean you haven't sent out acknowledgement orders yet?
We have sent out acknowledgement notices to the parties, and what that is just sort of an update of where things stand.
We have your appeal.
And let them know we have it. We're in the process of figuring out how we're going to handle these, and as soon as we get these docketed, we're going to be sending out acknowledgement orders. And again, it's my understanding that we're planning on getting those sent out shortly after Labor Day.
Yeah. Well, then there's all those 5,000 federal employees who actually suffered a personnel action not due to a furlough.
Well, that's
I know in my bar where I practice, you know, my colleagues who are out there in other law firms, there's a concern in the community for people who suffered a personnel action, an adverse personnel action that's not furlough-based, based upon misconduct or performance. There's a concern that they're going to get held up because the MSPB, you just have a certain number of bodies to do a certain number of work.
Right. The answer that I've been giving to people when they ask is we are human, but we do want to make sure that everybody knows that we are moving forward with the non-furlough cases. We know that, we have whistleblowers coming to us. We have people who have been suspended, people have been removed. We're processing those cases just as we normally would. It's just more difficult because of the volume. Like I said, we're a very small agency, so we're just doing the best we can.
Right. I'd be curious after the break from the other guests to see who wants to predict whether at any point Congress reinstates the funds so that you know, they get their back pay making out their furlough. This is what I'm sure MSPB is like praying at night. Every night they're praying, you know, that the funds get reinstated so that the back pay is reinstated and making the furlough appeals moot.
Which has generally been the case in the past, which is why there's not a lot of precedent on this issue, at least from a board standpoint.
Right. I think the sense in town is that's not going to happen. But, you know, I think it was the last time it was when they shut the government down in the early 90s. Everybody got their back pay from it. But I think the sense is not going to happen, which means MSPB is going to be adjudicating 32,000 appeals.
And, you know, that's just this year. I mean, if Congress makes certain decisions next year, this could be the new norm for us. We just don't know. I heard, I believe, Bruce or Michael allude to, you know, perhaps layoffs or riffs. That's something that the board would have to deal with as well if that were to happen. So this could really just be the beginning for us.
Right. Well, congratulations and welcome to your new post at MSPB.
Thank you.
And we certainly will be, I know we will be here at Fed Talk and in the federal community be watching very closely how MSPB handles sort of the, you know, the gush of appeals. I do want to circle back with Michael and Bruce on the judiciary, talk about this letter that just went out from the chief judges, but we need to take the final break of our show. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is, GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting this morning's show. We're talking about sequestration and the effect on the judiciary. I think a topic that has not been well covered at all in town. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in our show, and I wanted to circle back with Bruce Moyers. Bruce, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
And Bruce, I wanted to have you talk with our listeners regarding this letter that recently went out to the Vice President of the United States, who also happens to be the President of the U.S. Senate, from almost every chief judge in every judicial district of the United States. I was really overwhelmed when I read it. I don't think I've ever remember seeing anything like this before.
Yes, Deborah, that letter is unprecedented in the magnitude of signatories to the letter. First of all 87 federal district court chief judges, and secondly, the underlying subject of the letter and the unprecedented financial challenges that face the federal courts. But before I make another comment about that, could I just reach back to the MSPB, and since earlier in my legal career, I worked at MSPB during the first 8 years of its existence, which shows how far back that goes. It was created by the Civil Service
Reform. We're dating ourselves.
1979, I sure am. But it was during that time that those air traffic control cases walked in the door, I have a great respect for Brian and Michael, who are on the show as well, and the challenges that they face. And thinking about the 11,000 air traffic control cases and the considerable challenge that presented in consolidating cases according to common sets of facts and issues of law. And the fact these furlough cases that are now on the docket of the MSPB are almost four times in number of those air traffic control cases that we adjudicated three decades ago, with twice the staff that the MSPB has today, is just one more example of the challenges that government faces. And to put it in a little more human terms, in terms of this overall situation facing the federal courts and adjudicators, both in the executive branch, like Brian and the MSPB, as well as in the federal courts, federal adjudicators do not go out looking for cases. They receive the cases that walk in the door, that are filed in their clerk's offices every day. And they have the responsibility to promptly decide those cases. Fairness and due process assumes that there will be promptness in adjudication. And it's almost like that episode. I know I'm probably dating myself here, but when you think about the old Lucy series of Lucille Ball on the conveyor, working the conveyor belt in the candy factory.
Right.
Taking pieces of candy as they came out of the machine, putting them in boxes, and then the conveyor belt starts to speed up, and more pieces of candy come out, and she's taxed with the even greater challenge of getting those pieces of candy into the boxes. Well, this is the situation personified by the federal courts and by the MSPB, where the federal courts today have record levels of cases that they have to decide. The MSPB has record levels of cases it has to decide.
Yeah, Bruce, you have to wonder, like, is there a tipping point where that sort of I'm dating myself. I remember that episode, and there was a tipping point. I mean, it just came to an end. She couldn't do the job anymore. It just it collapsed, right? So I certainly, I don't want to put Brian on the spot because Brian's going to give me the government answer. Isn't there a tipping point at some point where you just, they throw up, it's like, I can't get it done. It's just, it shuts the place down. And I wonder, I've read, Michael, your testimony before the Senate Judiciary. I've read the letter from the federal courts to the Senate. And for our listeners who want to read this letter, because Bruce said it was unprecedented, I thought it was Bruce, and you've confirmed it. It was one of the most incredible things I think I'd ever read as an insider in town. You can, as a listener, if you want to read the letter, you can get a copy on it of it. We on this week's Fed Agent e-report, which is at fedagent.com, we report on this letter, and there's a click-through for a copy of it. We all talk about how it's affecting the system and all of the problems and how it's going to get worse, Michael. But, at some point, isn't there a tipping point? Like, it's just, it's done. We're done. Can't happen. Can't work. Won't work.
Well, the reality is that as federal public defenders and all of us on this show today are lawyers, ultimately we have a responsibility to our clients. And when this budget crisis hit in March, one of the first things that I did when I realized that we simply didn't have enough money to get through the year is I told my employees, and they agreed wholeheartedly, that the one thing we were not going to do was shortchange the clients that we had. We were not going to not do all of the work necessary, not hire the experts, not do the investigation for those clients that, as members of the bar, we had a responsibility to represent, especially those facing
years. So you work
and
you don't get
paid. That's exactly right.
Okay.
They understood that our obligations and our mission required us to sacrifice our own salaries. Now, that is unsustainable.
It's unsustainable because the MSPB is, they're not... They don't have attorney-client relationships. They don't have that ethical obligation.
No, I can approach it from a little bit of a different angle, although I can definitely appreciate what Michael's saying. Our agency is composed of individuals who are there because they want to be there. These are individuals, as Bruce probably knows very well, who are very, very dedicated to the board's mission, which is to protect the merit principles throughout the federal government. And, you know, you ask about a tipping point. I'm very confident in saying that there won't be one for us, even as strained and as overwhelmed as we are. We are composed of so many dedicated employees that we're just going to do what we can.
Right. But how long, you know, federal employees been under fire for at least 3 years. Bruce knows that, you know, no salary increases, now furloughs, maybe RIFs. You have to wonder, and I'm not demeaning sort of the commitment people make to the mission and their job. But at some point, you know, people are people, and will they work and not get paid? And you have to wonder if Congress, Congress, I think everybody in town feels Congress doesn't care about that. It's the politics of sequestration. But there are people involved, and it's very real, you know, from talking to people here on the show today, that there's all kinds of people. When we talk about the federal court system, the people, as Bruce said, who bring their disputes to the court, the judges don't go out looking for business. The disputes come to them. They're looking for the government to resolve. And, of course, then government workers who are looking to do their job to administer justice, they're affected. So there's all this effect on individual people, and I wonder, maybe that's my poli-sci major coming out, is there a tipping point? I'm not sure there's an answer to that, but at some point there's a give, you know. And I thought, Bruce, if you're there, I thought the letter from the judges, and you. I wonder, Michael, if your testimony is posted somewhere online, because it was really brilliant.
Thank you very much. It was on C-SPAN, and it's available on the Senate Judiciary website. And if I could just add, in addition to that letter, which is extraordinary, the Attorney General himself, Eric Holder, just published today, this morning, in the Washington Post, a piece directly on the need for adequate funding for the federal defender system. And I think that really is telling. You know, oftentimes there are two sides to an argument, and we try and understand what the other side is, even if we don't agree with it. There is no other side to this argument. The chief law enforcement officer of the United States, 87 chief judges, Seth Waxman, the former solicitor general, former U.S. attorneys, federal prosecutors and judges, people across the political spectrum, Senator Coons and Senator Sessions, jointly wrote a letter to the administrative office of the courts advocating for funding for federal defenders. There simply is no other side to this argument. And this is a crisis. And if there is not relief in the form of more money from Congress to the judiciary as a whole, not just to federal defenders, we will forever damage the federal courts that we hold out as the pride of our government. And we hold out with pride to other parts of the world that don't have the reputation and history of respect for the rule of law. And, you know, that's why Congress needs to act in the coming weeks, because we are going to do damage that can't be undone.
Yeah. Bruce, we have 30 seconds. What's your predictions for sequestration and CR in fiscal 14? 30 seconds.
Well, my prediction is that it's going to be a long, hard slog through 2014, a potential continuing resolution that would continue flat funding with some anomalies for the remainder of the 2014 cycle, with the possibility of resolution and a budget deal being reached in 2015. Not a real optimistic projection.
Right.
But that's the best.
More of the same. Bruce, thank you for being a guest on the show. Michael, thank you for being a guest. Brian, great to meet you. Thank you for being a guest. And for those of you out there, thank you for listening to Fed Talk.